This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
It's 6 o'clock and time again for Brain Matters, the official radio show of the UA Counseling Center. We are broadcasting from the campus of the University of Alabama. Good evening. My name is Dr. BJ Gunther, and I'm the host of the show. In case you don't know, this show is about mental and physical health issues that affect college students, and in particular, UA students. And you can listen to us each Tuesday night at 6 p.m. on 90.7 FM, or you can listen online at www.wvuafm.ua.edu, or you can also download the Crimson White app and click on the 90.7 live streaming link. So, also, I always ask every week for listeners to send me ideas for future shows. We have most of our shows covered for this semester, I think, but spring semester will need some upcoming issues or some trends in college mental health. So if you have ideas for me and the show, please email those to brainmattersradio@wvuafm.ua.edu, and of course I'll consider using your show topic. Tonight's topic is an interesting one. I think we had this person and this topic scheduled for pre-COVID, but had to cancel, of course, and have rescheduled them. Tonight, it's canines combating the opioid crisis. The opioid epidemic is not specific to one location. It's everywhere. And nearly every American community has been impacted by the crisis. So combating the opioid crisis frequently involves police officers, including their four-legged partners who have much more sensitive noses than we do. So tonight, my guest is joining us from Washington, D.C. Joshua Sullivan is the canine program manager, and he also specializes as the Alabama canine representative in the D.C. area. He's a trained diplomatic protection specialist, tactical SWAT medic, and acts as a supervisory canine manager in search service projects. Wow, that's a mouthful, Josh. Sorry.
It is a mouthful.
I got it mixed up or messed up. That is very impressive. How long have you been doing this?
So total between all of the background that you just went over, yeah. I've been – I guess since I was 21, I started corrections when I was 18 in Maryland, right outside of DC. And then I've just kind of progressed through becoming different avenues of law enforcement, private security, diplomatic security, and then fire and EMS as a volunteer since I was 16.
Wow. So give us a little bit more about yourself. Tell us how you became, you've given us your credentials, basically, but how did you become interested in the canine unit? Was that always a goal of yours, or how did it fall into your lap? That's interesting to
me. So actually, it was never a goal, never something I actually wanted to do. Growing up, I actually did not like big dogs. I had little dogs growing up. And I was actually working a pretty high level diplomatic event in Washington, D.C. that had multiple heads of state and other high diplomatic positions for the U.S. and abroad at the one event. And as the person in charge of the security for the entire event, I had to wake up at like 5 a.m., 4 a.m. to have a canine sweep done for the location we were doing the multiple day event at. Mm-hmm. So the individual that came out and was doing the canine sweep ended up having to go to the bathroom, long story short, and asked me to hold his dog for him after the search.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. And just from picking up a little bit of what I saw him doing and kind of what I paid attention to, when he came back, I had the dog laying next to my feet, which, truth be told, I don't know how I did it to this day. I'm not sure, you know, how I did it, or if he just laid down because he was tired. But the guy came back, and he was the owner of a pretty big company in the U.S. that did canine work. And we just got talking, and, you know, he asked for my information and said that he was looking for somebody in the D.C. area to do some canine work and you know, potentially take that as a stepping stone. And it wasn't until about 6 months after that we actually talked, and it kind of fell into my lap, and I went through the basic handler course, ended up going through a trainer's course. And then from there, it just kept going. Ended up with that company, I ended up getting multiple federal contracts and big contracts for them. I'm at $1 million contracts with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and all sorts of stuff. And just kind of worked my way through becoming the head of the canine program, and then transitioning into Alabama Canine Law Enforcement Officers Training Center, which is a mouthful in itself.
Yes.
That's who I work for now as their canine program manager and their federal canine program manager. So with them, like you alluded to, I kind of act as a supervisory canine in charge of all the canine programs that we do, whether it's narcotics, explosives, accelerant, cadaver, any of the actual services we provide, as well as, you know, our federal contracts and our federal contracting side. So it's a busy time of year.
It does. And it sounds very overwhelming because there's so much that goes into it. I mean, just you and your canine officer, think of the training that goes into both you and the dog.
Absolutely.
You mentioned being a handler, taking a basic handler course. Can anybody take that? Or are you talking specifically for law enforcement?
So it's at Alabama Canine. We don't normally train anybody but law enforcement, military, or government employees.
Okay.
We work with tier one law enforcement agencies and tier one military organizations. The ATF's tactical group actually does a lot of work with us. The SAS in England, in the UK, they buy all their dogs, and we train with them quite a bit. There's over 2,500 police departments around the world train with us, buy their dogs from us, and have their handler training done by us, as well as we do instructor training and all that. It just so happened, because of my law enforcement background, I was able to take on a part-time job, basically, is what it was with that first company, and took the police handler course.
Wow.
I went through my basic handler course.
How long is it?
So it depends on where you go. At Alabama Canine, just to be a detection handler, so that's only for one of the detection principles, so either narcotics or explosives or accelerant or whatever. At Alabama Canine, that's about a 5 to 6 week course. Monday through Friday, we have dorms, we have the whole nine yards at our facility.
Intensive.
Yeah. And it's very intensive. There's written tests, there's memorization you have to do. And then of course, working with the dog and getting certified internationally. So it's a very intensive, very, informative, and you train every day.
Tell us more. I'm writing down some questions so I can remember to ask you, but specifically tell the listeners about Alabama, the program, Alabama Combating the Opioid Crisis, okay? Just describe it a little bit.
So the Combating the Opioid Crisis is just part of our we have two things that we're doing. Alabama Canine as a whole, our owner, Ricky Farley, which Ricky is a very, very well-known person throughout Tuscaloosa and the whole country and the police world, but especially in the Tuscaloosa and Northport where he is. He's a very, very well-known person. He's had the company since 1992, I believe, where he became the owner and started running it. And I mean, again, 2,500 plus police departments, canine teams that we've sent out certified, as well as doing tier one operations. And then a couple of years ago when I came on board with the company, before Ricky took a little break from some of the federal side and contracting to raise his daughters, he was very heavily intertwined with the U.S. federal government as a provider of canine services and training. And that's one of the things he wanted to kind of come back with once his daughters, which all of them actually work for Alabama Canine as trainers or, in the office and are doing a great job. He wanted to kind of get back into that, which is where I came in. So we opened up the office here in the DC area. And our goal is to provide canine services of any kind. So whether it's, again, explosives, narcotics, patrol, accelerant, cadaver, even bed bugs. We actually last year we just spent got bed bug dog.
Wow.
Certified that we can find bed bugs in hotels, nursing homes, stuff like that. So any of those type things that we do, either federally or private level, is kind of where we come in. So in doing that, and then with my background in emergency medicine, I've been an EMT basic. I got certified, I think, in 2002. I took advanced courses, SWAT and tactical medic courses. And I'm a active volunteer in a suburb of Washington, D.C. in Maryland. We run a lot of calls. And on a daily basis, I my pager goes off from, at driving the fire truck or ambulance for overdoses. I mean, yeah. I think if I counted up in my locality in the past 24 hours, I've probably heard 5 or 6 overdose calls go out just in the past 24 hours. Keep going or stop?
Going.
I saw a hand
going.
Okay.
Yeah, my question is, first of all, you mentioned Alabama Canine. Is that the camp that's located, I think, up 69 between Northport and Jasper?
I'm not too all familiar with the actual.
I think it is.
I know it's in Samantha, if that helps.
Okay. I think it is. And I think it was hit by the tornado in 2011. It was one of the places that they had some structural damage. 'Cause I just remember worrying about the dogs, some donations too,
It very well may be. I know we did. We actually have still been upgrading all of our facilities. Last year, we actually had a state of the art training facility opened up. And the last year, beginning of this year, which later on I'll give you guys the website. We have pictures up and that you can see. We have indoor kennels, outdoor kennels, a huge training facility inside, bathing, grooming.
Can any dog be trained to be a canine officer? Or are there some?
No.
I know we used to live next to a Tuscaloosa Police Department officer, and he had, oh my gosh, what kind of, is it a Belgian Malinois?
Malinois.
Yes, Malinois. That dog scared me to death. It is humongous, and it would lay out on the porch. It was an apartment, so our porches would join, and I would walk out the door, and it would be like right there in my face. And it was not mean. It was sweet,
right.
But
it was intimidating. Right. It wasn't mean until it was told to be.
Oh, thank you for that. Yep. Yeah.
And we call them alligators because they're
I'm glad I didn't know that then. Oh.
Yep. They're very high energy all the time dogs. My dog is trying to play with me right now. He got groomed today, so he's done being mad at me for having to go take a bath and all that with the groomer.
So it really needs to be a bigger dog, right? Because of what you're doing.
It does, and most times. For the law enforcement purposes, it has to be a bigger dog. A, you want that intimidation factor. Mm-hmm. You look at some of the stuff going on in the world today, and it's kind of funny to say this sometimes to certain people, but you can have 20 officers in riot gear, and people won't bat an eye. They'll go towards them. They'll try to do whatever they need. But you have one canine at the very front barking at people and showing his teeth, and those people will turn around and walk away.
Exactly.
So that's kind of one of the benefits of the bigger, better dogs. But, I have a long-haired German Shepherd, and he's about 60 pounds. He's fluffy, but he can do his job very well. He's an explosives patrol dog. One of my handlers, Matt, he has he's probably a 80-pound German Shepherd that sits up probably 4 feet in the air, and if he stands up, it's probably taller than me, and I'm 6'3". He has that look, and he's a narcotics detection dog. So it really all depends on what they're doing and what their mission is. I would have to say, going back to the original question, they probably are. I know that they have some pretty bad weather down there on a regular basis, and I think they were involved with that. But yeah, they
probably
sit close to North Point and Samantha.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar. How? A couple of questions. How do officers get assigned dogs? And what if the dog and the officer don't mix? What if they, there's like some kind of clash, or the dog just doesn't like the officer or vice versa? What happens? I hate to ask that, but
It's a good question. So I'm a parent. I'm not sure if you're a parent or not, but I'm
40,000 students.
There you That's go. You're enough. A parent. You're a parent.
I don't see all of them.
as just like kids, some dogs just have different personalities, and some people just can't get along. So one of the things that we do is, as far as training and mating the dog to the handler, it's a process. So normally, as a canine handler coming in, if their department doesn't specifically say, okay, we want this type of dog, we want this color dog, we want this mannerism, normally we'll have multiple dogs that person can work. When they work those dogs over the first couple of days and couple of weeks of the course, the instructors, as well as the student, the handler, kind of start seeing who they work best with, who they kind of pair up well with, the personalities kind of start intertwining, because dogs have personalities just like kids too. So it really is kind of a pairing that takes place over some time, unless the chief of the department or whoever comes and says, we want that dog right there, you'll make it work. And you know, it's one of those things where we can't always guarantee that they're going to work well together, but we'll do what we can to get it
done. And they're chosen, they would specifically be chosen for their specific skills.
Right. So we have some dogs that, and what the other part of the question that you'd ask was, can any dog do it? We have a very, very, very rigorous selection testing that we put through any of the dogs that we're going to use. Some of these dogs from birth are in kennels that are working dog kennels that are developed to be canines. And some are just, you know, donations that just have the drive and the ability. Something as simple as, you know, if you're a puppy and we take the ball from you and somebody else is holding your leash and we're in a fenced in yard and I throw the ball, how fast you know, how much you pay attention and how much you want that ball to go get it. Wow. Same time we throw the ball, turn the dog around a couple times, how far and how long will he search for that ball until he finds it? Do you get aggressive when we take the ball from you and actually try to like get it? You know, there's a lot of different things that go into it, as well as the bloodline. You know, the bloodline's important as well. So it takes a very certain dog to do police work.
So this is your dog for life. When you are assigned a canine officer, he is yours until one or the other dies. And I hate to say it that morbidly, but he is yours for the rest of the dog's life.
Okay. Not always. Different departments have different rules when it comes to that, because at the end of the day, as much as, you know, with my dog, he's 7 and a half now. My dog is now mine. If something happens, he will always be mine. However, certain departments, including the military is one of the bigger ones, and we work with the military. Mm-hmm. The military is one of the bigger ones where you can have 5 different handlers on a dog in a matter of a year because of the military deployments and stuff like that. And you know, those dogs don't get to go home with the handlers, where you know, most departments let them take them home as part of the family. So it really depends. I'd say, if I had to put a number on it, I'd say 75 to 80% of dogs are the handlers for life. You know how it usually works out.
I've had a show a few years ago where I invited one of the UAPD officers and her canine unit to come to the studio, you know, in studio with us and sit in the studio so I could meet the dog. And it was just a general show about canine units. And I think UAPD has, at the time, I think they only had 1 or 2. I don't know how many they have now, but that opened my eyes to just how law enforcement uses dogs, because even though I live next to an officer way back when, I didn't really talk to him a whole lot. He was busy, he was gone, so I didn't really understand kind of what you're talking about. We're going to take a quick break, Josh, if you'll hang on, and we'll come back in just a minute, because I want to talk more specifically about when a canine program started, but also how they're helping to solve the opiate crisis, or at least help with it. I don't know if solve is the good word to use, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7. I'm Dr. BJ Gunther. Tonight we've got a very interesting show. It's canines combating the opioid crisis, especially here in the state of Alabama and a lot of other states. And we're going to talk about the prevalence of the opioid crisis throughout the country. But my guest tonight is Josh Sullivan. Josh is joining us from Washington, D.C. He has a lot of titles, but he's canine program manager in the D.C. area and the Alabama canine representative. He's also a diplomatic protection specialist, tactical SWAT medic, and supervisory canine manager in search service projects. So you are very busy, as you described at the beginning of the show. And we were talking during the break about the animals and that the dogs mostly used are shepherds, Malinois, and starting to use giant schnauzers, which that completely shocks me because that just seems like an old man dog to me, but whatever. And also that the dogs come to the officers already named, because they come at what age? How old are they?
So most of the breeders that we work with, they come and we start their training between a year and usually 2 years old.
Okay. I mean,
just generalizing it. And they all come named like I was talking about during the break, Bach, which is my dog. He's a long-haired German Shepherd. He's actually from Slovakia, has a passport, the whole nine yards when they come over. And so most of the dogs usually come from the bigger working dog breeding lines, which are overseas in Slovakia, Holland, Germany.
So does he understand? I'm assuming he understood English when he got here.
Not at all. So
what?
We actually get these lists, right? And it's easier for some reason to teach a handler how to speak commands in another language than it is a dog for them to remember a different language.
That is shocking. Yeah.
So he speaks Czechoslovakian for most of his commands. Now, as a trainer, I've trained him a couple of things. If we're going somewhere and we have to hurry up and try to get back into a search or something, I can say a thing to make him go to the bathroom, or you know, I can make him bark nicely instead of the aggressive bark that they're trained to do by saying, you know, speak or something like that. But for the actual big commands, it's all in Czech.
Yeah, I always do a little bit of research for the show, so that I kind of know a little bit about the topic or know what quick questions I want to ask you. And I saw a piece on, I think it was on PBS, but it was a short little video about using canine units for detection of opioids and how dangerous it is. And I want to ask you a little more about that in a minute. But one of the lady reporters, one of the women reporters, you know, she was doing this is what you always see with canine units on TV. You see people in their big, you know, cover on their arm, and then you see them call the, you know, the dog, and he attacks the arm, right? And I've always thought that would be so much fun to do, but I don't know. I'm only 5'2", so I don't know if that would work with Bach.
You know, it's kind of terrifying the first time you do it. And mine was in the summer in San Antonio, Texas. And the dog was probably just as big as I was, and I was terrified.
No.
But after that first hit, and you feel it through the suit sometimes, and, you know, you'll get scratches and be bleeding a little bit sometimes, depending on how big the dog is, but it's not bad. And it's kind of a rush. Pretty much everything I do in life is adrenaline based.
Sounds like it. Between the fire service
and the law enforcement side. And so it was fun. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Hey, let's talk about the really dangerous aspect, though, because this is in my research that I read about and watched some of the videos. I mean, this is dangerous work these dogs are doing. It is very dangerous work with opioids, fentanyl. How do you prepare? I guess you don't. I mean, you just go through your training and the dog goes through its training, but talk about the danger.
So it's, you know, when it comes to the drugs, and that's, I mean, obviously what we're talking about more today is the opioids, the drugs, narcotics, what we call controlled dangerous substances in the police world. When we're talking about CDS, I'll kind of cover all of our dogs. We have the option for the department. A lot of the departments want every drug put on the dog that they can find. Some, with the legalization of marijuana and cannabis, some are starting to take that off just because of different court precedences that are going on. But most of our dogs, when they're drug dogs, they're trained to be able to find heroin, cocaine, marijuana, methamphetamines, MDMA, LSD, PCP, and then derivatives of all of them. So when you start getting into the fentanyl, obviously we're talking about the opiates and heroin. And that, you know, for people that don't know, fentanyl is a synthetic opiate, which is 80 to 100 times stronger than morphine itself. You know, pharmaceutical fentanyl has been used for a long time to treat different pains and different stuff. And then you saw it start getting cut in with heroin and laced into heroin to give them that extra high. And most of it comes from Mexico. And so doing interdiction and highway interdiction and learning about all the different routes of from Mexico up and out to the United States, Alabama is a big corridor from that coming from.
This over from 2059 New Orleans and, corridor.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
So one of the things about fentanyl, obviously, is that because what can fit on the tip of your fingernail, on your pinky finger, being 80 to 100 times stronger. It's one of those things where if you just touch it as an officer, you know, you see these videos on YouTube and go around on the news that you just touch it as an officer and absorbs into an open cut or anything that's, you know, airway wise, you know, they're overdosing.
Yep.
You know, not only are we carrying Narcan or Naloxone for ourselves, now you start getting into the dog world for it.
And Narcan counteracts the fentanyl or the opiate, right?
Correct. Yep.
It reverses.
Yep. It reverses it basically, when heroin and any of the opiates get in your system, your respiratory system gets kind of closed down. There's a pressure on it. So what it does is it actually releases that pressure and lets it all go back out. And you know, depending, you know, not to go into too much, but you know, I Narcan somebody, I think yesterday, the day before, the last one I did. And, you know, it depends on how much they took and how fast it works. You know, sometimes you'll have somebody that took so much drugs or so much, whatever the case may be, that it might take 4 milligrams, 6 milligrams, 8 milligrams, and it might take 20 minutes of actually hyperventilating them with a bag valve mask and oxygen. And then you'll get the people that didn't take that much, that just had a bad batch or something mixed, that didn't know. Then you shoot 1 milligram in each nostril and you pump the bag a couple times and they come up swinging.
They're fine. Have you ever had a Narcan a dog?
So I've never had to do a live Narcan on a dog. I got close a couple times, but the dog actually was fine. One of the things about dogs and drugs is opiates actually are 20 times less of a problem for a canine. So what would do damage to us, it's 20 times better for a dog. They're actually resistant to it, opiates, more than we are.
Yeah. Almost like snake bites.
Absolutely.
In a weird way, you know.
But the other thing is, it's weird because our, you know, I think we'll talk about it later on, but, you know, the receptors that a human and a dog have when it comes to opioid receptors are the exact same. However, the dogs are still 20% more likely to not be affected than we are based on their sensitivity.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And that's one of the questions I came up with about the receptors, because I thought that was so fascinating. So I didn't know that they're not as affected. So they've got more of a tolerance almost, maybe.
Absolutely.
I don't know. So, okay, you mentioned Alabama and this 2059 corridor. Is Alabama a hot spot for opioids? And if so, do you know any of the statistics for our state?
I do. So one of the things for my job is I have to know all the statistics for all the states, because we are a national service. We have teams across the country. We have teams able to deploy across the country. And some of the things we'll get into in a couple of questions further down, kind of what we do with that. But Alabama, just for 2018, was 775 reported drug overdose deaths. And out of those fatalities, a total of 381, which is almost half, were opiate related. The reasoning, and this is one of the fun things that you kind of, well, not fun, but when you're researching it, you start looking into different avenues and different ways people are dying from it, opiate addiction or overdoses. Alabama is the number one provider in 2018 of opiate prescriptions.
All that we heard about Ohio, you know, for so long we were hearing about Ohio. Are you saying that a lot of it was coming from Alabama? Am I hearing you right?
So I can't necessarily say that, but what I can say is that
I didn't know if I understood you.
That Alabama wrote the most prescriptions for opiates.
And that's not good.
You know, and you know, there are different routes, of course, that people take to get what they need, right? So some people go the illegal route. Some people go the legal route where they get a doctor that might not be fully, you know, doing what they're supposed to do and vetting everything, and then they take it and do what they need to do with it. And like I said, in 2018, Alabama providers medically wrote 97.5 prescriptions for every 100 people. So that kind of does the number. That's the highest prescriber rate in the country, and twofold than the average U.S. rate, which is 51% of 100 people. You know, 2018, it might not be something that is publicized because not every state obviously wants their numbers out there.
Yes.
But the overall answer to is Alabama a hotspot would be yes. And the easier answer is at this point in the world in 2020, every state is a hotspot in its own right.
Do you know how I'm sure it's prevalent on college campuses, but do you know anything about this campus that you could share? Because I've been working here for like 15 years, and you know, this sounds really weird, but every year it's like a new fix. It's going to be something new. One year it might be cocaine. One year it might be, you know, meth. One year it might be patches. We had one year where people were putting patches on and having overdoses, you know, you know what I mean.
So I don't know the actual statistics for the University of Alabama. I could find that out, and I can definitely get back with you and let you know. But off the top of my head, I don't know about the university itself.
What about most college campuses, though? Is it
most college campuses are absolutely.
Okay.
You know, you kind of start looking at the breakdown of the demographics and the age groups and all the different stuff. You know, it's kind of drugs in the United States kind of go off a pattern. When you get into college age kids, a lot more cocaine or a lot more LSD, MDMA is used than the heroin. But we found over the past 5 or 10 years that there's been a significant increase in some of the harder heroin, cocaine, acid, you know, stuff like that.
Yes.
So it's kind of one of those things where it's all kind of creeping up together. But then when heroin became they're able to manufacture heroin for a lot cheaper now from Mexico and even in the U.S. using different stuff. When that started happening, that became a cheaper alternative than a lot of other things became.
Sure.
So you started getting that progression of off of weed, off of cocaine, back onto the harder stuff just because it was more readily available.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you want the U.S. statistics. You know, we talked about the Alabama.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of shocking. 2018, because, you know, it takes a couple of years for everybody to get the stats out.
That's right.
2018, there were 67,367 overdoses or deaths. Which is actually 4.1% fewer than 2017, but only, you know, very, very minor rate.
Yeah.
But where the difference is even though there is fewer overdose deaths, the amount of opiate-related went up. So opiates were involved in 46,802 out of the 67,000. So 70% of all the overdose deaths
were opioids.
In 2018 were opioid-related.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's definitely, if we can continue the trend down on overdose deaths all together, it'd be amazing, obviously.
It's just, but, it just seems like what I was reading, it just seems like, you know, you cut off one thing and it starts flooding on the other side. It's like having a leak in your house, you know.
Absolutely.
You just can't cut off the water for everything. It's just going to come in no matter what you do, like you're trying your hardest. We're going to take one more break, Josh, and then when we come back for our last segment, I want you to walk us through when you would use the dog, when you would use Bok, because is that every time you go out, or when is the dog called to be used? And walk us through actually what happens when you go out, okay?
Absolutely.
So hang on just a minute. We'll be right back. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. Tonight, our topic is combating the opioid crisis using canines. And my guest tonight is Josh Sullivan, joining us from Washington, D.C. And he is over just about every canine program you can think of. I'm kidding. It's a lot. He does a lot. He's a medic. He's a canine program manager. He has a canine officer himself. Now, are these dogs, Josh, are they actual officers? Are they, you know, do they go through a ceremony just like human officers do?
So the police canines, they do actually. Most departments actually have a whole graduation from the academy.
Wow.
You know, they come in, they give them a little dog cake treat, whatever they want to do. Most of them have their own badges, badge numbers. In the military, even the dogs are sergeants, so they're usually they're higher ranking than the handlers are, which I think is hilarious. But,
so you can't name your dog sergeant. It would be sergeant, right?
Sergeant.
Yeah.
Call him Sarge. But it really all depends. You know, for our dogs, you know, we work for Alabama Canine. Obviously, we're not a police organization. However,
yes,
the dogs are certified through the International PSP, Police Service Dog 1 certification, the same as any other police dog. So they are police dogs. They are certified police dogs. It's just whether they're actually using a police function or not, which is kind of where it comes into what we do and how we're able to do it, which is what
so
you had said before the break.
Walk us through what happens. When would you be utilized with Bok?
So, as Alabama Canine's concerned, what we do is we offer a couple of different things. One of the things that I was very passionate about and started an initiative was called this Keep School Safe Initiative. And what this does is it's a whole program that we laid out, and we're actually putting civilian detection teams into schools. And the benefit of that is, again, you look at where we are in the world today. Right now is not a fun time to be a police officer. You know, right now there's a lot of stuff going on politically, on all ends of the arena where,
yes,
you know, defund the police, all this kind of stuff's going on. What we're able to do is take that whole equation and the whole bad relationship possibility out of the equation.
Yes.
We put civilian non-police handlers with a trained dog into schools. That's something that they can become part of the team with. They're part of the staff, the school. They can be, you know, I've heard some of them going into yearbooks as, you know, as one of the staff faculty. And what we're able to do is instead of taking that police approach to discipline, because everybody thinks about it, well, okay, well, if the police dog is in the school and they find something, obviously that person is going to get charged.
Right.
Well, we take that out of the equation. As we all know, addiction is it's a disease. You know, sometimes being arrested for it can hurt more than it can help.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes treatment's what's needed instead of reform in a prison. So, you know, there's a lot of aspects that we're able to help with because we're a civilian team versus a police team. So we have different contracts. One of the partnerships we actually are with is the Recovery Centers of America. We have one that's actually pretty local to us, and the Recovery Center of America, we go out at least once a month. And then if they have other issues or they think they may have something going on, we come in and search their facilities. We actually just had one of our teams do the local one, I think, Monday, so yesterday. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of different things we can do. So if we're in a school, you know, the same as wherever, we can do one school system. Let's say they have 30 schools in their school system. Mm-hmm. You know, once a week they go to, you know, they go to, or two times a week they go to three different schools and they do random searches of lockers, random searches of classrooms, book bags, stuff like that. Very non-intrusive unless we have a find. And then if we do have an alert where the dog sits or indicates that there's a substance that they're trained to locate, then the administrators get involved. We do a search, and if we find something, that they are able to take that action and whatever recourse they want, to where instead of a police dog, where the charges would have to be filed.
Right. So basically, you've done your job at that point.
Correct. And it's something that's also allowed us that we actually offer multiple different types of that service, not only just in schools. We offer a public search service. So, you know, Dr. BJ has a son that's at home. He's been battling drugs and addiction. We finally got him ready to go get help in a program. One of the things that we find in the psychology of addiction is people aren't dumb. You know, they might have an addiction, they might have a disease, but they're not dumb. So what they do is they stash things for later. And one of the biggest relapses in recovery that we've found through working with different programs is that people have these stashes, they come back clean, and then they're faced with that decision. Okay, well, I found my stash, what do I do? And that's one of the things we're also able to help with on a personal level. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, Dr. BJ calls Josh over at Alabama Canine and says, hey, we need a dog sweep at the house. My son's in recovery. He's going to get out in a week, and we want to make sure he has a safe environment to come home to. And we come through discreetly, you know, no uniforms, no police, no badge, no gun. You know, we come through and we're able to search that house properly with the dog, which is 9,000 times better at finding stuff than the human is. And we can make sure that it's a safe environment for them to
Hey, I got to ask you, this is going to be a weird question. Okay. You can answer or you can.
I'm ready.
But I bet you've been asked worse. Where's the most unusual place that you have, Bach has found a stash?
So Bach again is explosives. I had a narcotics dog, and I actually have another narcotics dog.
Yep.
So, but I've worked a narcotics dog for a long time as well. I actually am a dual handler. So I actually have a Bach, and then I normally have a narcotics patrol dog as well. So my new dog, cause, Miss Lexi just retired back in Alabama in Tuscaloosa, from her drug job. Probably the weirdest thing that we found stuff, inside toilets in a bag, you know, the top part of the toilets, inside, toilet paper rolls, inside medical supplies. People that have issues will do whatever they can.
I've watched Locked Up Abroad.
Absolutely.
They swallow these drugs. Can dogs detect? Okay, this is a really weird question. Can dogs detect drugs inside a human body?
So I don't think so. And I'd have to
without
look at some
getting
of the studies.
Weird.
Yeah, I would have to look at some of the studies. I don't think so. Now, on the explosive side, there are dogs at the airports that are trained to alert to what's called a individual worn or person worn improvised explosive device. And so basically you're walking by, you have a bomb on you on a vest or in a book bag.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
They can actually alert to that as you walk by instead of actually, you know, do stuff like that. The difference is that's not usually inside the body.
Being
it's on inside the body and being sealed and all that. Right. So,
you know,
so to my knowledge, no, unfortunately, I don't think they can figure out the drugs are in the person, but there's other ways to figure that out that the airport's really good at.
And, you know, we talked about how dangerous fentanyl is for humans and for dogs too. But when you say that Bach is an explosive detection dog, that just gives me chill bumps, you know. And how many dogs have you had yourself personally? Can I ask?
So So how many I've had assigned to me permanently is just Buck.
Right.
I had Lexi, which is a drug lab. Uh-huh. I had her for about a year and a half. And then I've worked other dogs here and there for different details or assignments as needed.
Have you ever lost any?
A dozen. Working? No, not yet.
Okay. I hate to ask that, but my curiosity, you know, this is dangerous. This is dangerous work.
I personally haven't worked, lost any, but I know of handlers and I'm friends with handlers and colleagues that have.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we were talking about earlier was the naloxone for humans. One of the cool things is that they've also found that intranasal naloxone actually works for dogs just the same.
Wow.
Okay. So, you know, it's one of the things that are embedded in our training programs for handlers immediately. You know, one of the first things we go over in handler school is the medical side of how to take care of anything medical that could happen to that dog, whether it's injury, illness, overdose.
Almost like a vet.
Absolutely. And basically, some of my local DC area teams, the first time something happens to their dog, they call me, Hey, Josh, we have this going on. The dog slid on the concrete and ripped part of its paw, pad off. Okay, well, let's take the pad off. Let's wrap it up, you know, make sure it's clean. Like, thankfully we're in a position that the dogs, you know, especially being medical already for humans.
Yeah, you're a medic already. It helps.
It's kind of easy to figure out what to do and all that. And we have a really close working relationship with our vets as well.
Josh, how is your program funded?
So we are a for-profit company. We're not a 501c3 or anything like that. We are funded by the work and the contracts that we do.
Yes.
Not to say we don't take donations. And
that's what
say
I was
going to
ask. Do you take donations of any kind? And
we do.
Most people don't turn that down.
Yeah. And we also, there are times that we do free services as well. At the end of the day, even though we're for profit, our job and what I took an oath when I became a public servant at 16, even with the fire department, and then all the way through now, my job is to help people no matter what the cause is. So if it means, somebody that can't afford it, but has a very, very,
a necessity,
weird situation where we need to help them.
Yes.
You know, there's sometimes that we'll do what we have to do and just kind of run the dog and say, look, don't worry about it. You know, we'd just rather make sure your family member is safe or make sure this is going on.
Right.
We try not to do that too often, but you know, when it needs to happen, we'll do that. We're human, and our number one priority is making sure our citizens and our brothers and sisters are safe.
That's right. We're going to wrap up the show in just a minute, but I want to ask you, is there anything that you need to talk about that you feel like listeners need to know that I haven't asked you or that you'd like to touch on?
Well, I think
any resources for listeners that you want to mention?
Yeah, I think it's and that's what I was about to do. Addiction is not necessarily a problem that you should be embarrassed about. You know, it's going to kill you if you don't get help. If you know somebody that needs help, there's places like us that are resources available to help with that. You know, we can put you in contact with different rehab facilities and programs that we work with, as well as help you make that transition. We have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We have a website. The website's www.alcanine.com, all spelled out. So ALCANINE.com.
Okay.
Our Facebook is at Alabama Canine. Our Instagram, I think, is at Alabama Canine, spelled out. And we also, especially for people on the campus, let's talk non-drug related real quick.
Yeah.
If you have dogs and you live on campus or going on a vacation, we have boarding, we have grooming, we have training for civilian dogs for obedience.
Good idea.
We do a little bit of everything. But the biggest thing is don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, there's companies out like us that are discreet. We don't want to embarrass you, but we want to make sure you're safe or your relatives or loved ones are.
I can say your job is
we work for businesses, we work for individuals, we work for all of that.
It sounds like your job is a lot like mine, and I bet you agree. It's never boring.
It is never boring. There is always a phone call at all times of the night, or there's always a problem that has to be solved in a manner that you would never figure out unless you had to get put into the situation.
Yeah, you have to have pretty good problem solving skills too, don't you?
Absolutely.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's an hour later up there, so I appreciate it. It's like 6 o'clock where you are. So yep, I appreciate it so much.
Not a problem. Thank you for having us. Anytime, we would love
Sounds
to be back.
Great. We may have questions. To have you on again.
Absolutely.
Take care. Let me make a few announcements before we close. As always, I want you not to forget our shows are recorded and podcasted on the audioboom.com website. Just type in Brain Matters and you'll find some of our past shows. There's also a link to Audio Boom on the Counseling Center's website at counseling.ua.edu. And I always want to thank a few people who've made the show possible. Dr. Greg Vanderwall, he's our executive director of the Counseling Center. Terry Siggers from the Office of Student Media. My production assistant is Catherine Howell. Of course, my colleagues at the Counseling Center and the WVUA staff. And my guest tonight, Joshua Sullivan. I call him Josh. I asked him if I could. Join us next week when the topic, this is going to be an interesting topic and one that I think all of us therapists can relate to. It's called helper burnout. Thanks again for listening tonight, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
This show is not intended as a substitute for professional counseling. Further, the views, opinions, and conclusions expressed by the show hosts or their guests are their own and not necessarily those of the University of Alabama, its officers, or trustees. Any views, opinions, or conclusions shared on the show do not create a relationship between the host or any guest and any listener, and such a relationship should never be inferred. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, please contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.